Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
There were three ravens sat on a tree, down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, dairy, 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 down, down."
Welcome to Local Legends, a series of interviews from the Three Ravens podcast with remarkable people who have singular perspectives on England's folklore, heritage and historic counties. My name's Martin Vaux, and today I'm speaking to Kirsty Hartsey-Otis. Author of several excellent books, including The Anthology of English Folk Tales, Suffolk Folk Tales, Suffolk Ghost Tales, and Ballad Tales, an anthology of English ballad tales retold, Kirsty is a leading light in English folklore. I'm talking to Kirsty this week in relation to Suffolk, the county where she grew up, but she has lived all over England as well as in Greece and has written books about the folklore of other counties too, in addition to serving as a museum curator, one of those dream jobs most of us can only aspire to. As you will hear, she currently works with Swindon Museums, but has been in the heritage industry for 30 years, dealing with diverse subjects including decorative and fine art, cemeteries, transport, local history, and archaeology. As if these were not enough strings to her bow, Kirsty also has degrees in the history of art, medieval studies and museum studies. She writes regularly for periodicals and journals and is the editor of the William Morris Society Journal with an expertise in the arts and crafts movement. In addition to which, she is also, of course, a storyteller extraordinaire. Described by Three Ravens hero Dr. Ronald Hutton as good as it gets. Her specialist areas are English, Celtic and Greek stories, and she gives talks and tells tales everywhere, from historic sites and museums to churches and festivals. Her clients have included the National Trust, the Wildfowl and Wetlands Trust, Bath Literature Festival, Waterstones, Gloucester History Festival, and many, many others. For 5 years, she kept a cracking blog too, covering her travels and musings about England's heritage, art, landscape and stories, which I highly recommend reading. It's available along with links to all of her books and work in general on her website at kirstyhartsiotis.com. I was overjoyed that Kirsty could carve out an hour or so to speak to me, and I dearly hope we'll chat again before long. I say this as we only scratched the surface of her depth of knowledge and extraordinary career and her detailed understanding of Suffolk's folklore. Nonetheless, she has museums to curate, talks to give, and stories to tell. Still, like a shooting star caught in a butterfly net, I managed to lure Kirsty to sit with me around the campfire and engaged in a wonderful conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So, without further ado, here is my chat with a true local legend, the medievally marvellous Kirsty Hartsiotis. Kirsty, one of the first things I have to ask you about is how did you get into museum curation? Because that's an unusual thing to do.
Well, I don't think it is an unusual thing to do. When you have a passion for history and for art and for things. I did my degrees in very useful things in art history. I fell in love with the Pre-Raphaelites when I was about 13, and I went to Cyprus to visit my father, and he had a poster on his wall, and I said, "I like your hippie poster." And he's like, "You haven't heard of the Pre-Raphaelites?" bought me a book, and I was completely hooked. I went to university, and I had no idea that you could actually work with this stuff. But I got a bit sidetracked whilst I was at university and ended up being interested in medieval architecture. So I went and did a degree at York in medieval studies and stuck around because York's very nice, and didn't get very far in the world of work, I have to say. It didn't seem like I was particularly cut out for that kind of thing. I eventually got a job as a tour guide on those, you know, open top buses. And whilst I was signing on the dole, as you could in those far off days in the 90s and still have a life, and there was a little note was put up: if you want an extra £10 on your dole, you can do voluntary work at the cemetery.
Oh, wow.
So I went to work to volunteer at York Cemetery, which was a fantastic thing to do. I mean, it was obviously a very exciting place to work. In fact, a couple of times you could hire the cemetery in the evening, and I hired it with a group of friends and we had parties there.
At the cemetery?
Yeah. In those days, I had a group of friends and we all enjoyed dressing up parties. And so we had a Chaucer party there. We actually put on a Chaucer play there, and we had a Wyatt Earp party and all sorts of things. It was good fun. But it was an introduction to museum documentation, because I typed up the burial records for the cemetery, which started in 1837 when the graves of York were overflowing. And I do mean literally, when there was a flood, the corpses would wash down the street.
Goodness me.
If you go to some of the cemeteries in York, you'll see that they're very high, much higher than the road.
Okay. That's science, that
burials,
is.
Burials, yes.
Yeah.
And so it's part of the public cemeteries that happened across the UK in Britain. So this was a Victorian cemetery, and still the functioning cemetery of York to this day. And it was really good because they did education work there, and I presume they still do. And so, as well as typing up the burial records, I also took school groups around where we did trails about the Victorians, about the wars, and a senses trail where we explored nature in the cemetery, because it was like a little nature reserve. And part of what I did also was to work with what was called in those days the Archaeological Resource Centre, that's now called DIG, where they did kind of experimental archaeology for children.
Wow.
So it showed you what experimental archaeology was, and you got to have a go at things. So there was a Viking loom there, for example, that we all used to work at when there wasn't a school group in, and spinning, and Roman sandals, which really we were only tying up. But also then how the process of an excavation starts. And because I'd done my degree in medieval studies, which had been in Anglo-Saxon material mostly, I had a grounding in archaeology. Which I have to say has been very useful in folkloric studies.
How super for young children to be able to get their hands on and really play and experiment and understand that, although a lot of these things are professionalised, anyone can engage in a local archaeological project. They're happening up and down the country all the time. All you need to do is just search on the internet and you will find lots of people who want to get stuck in.
Yeah. So from that, a heritage career seemed like the thing to do. And I got a job at the Railway Museum in York doing front of house. And then I went off to go and do yet another degree because there was no choice. And then I eventually got a curatorial job way down in Bath. And I have to confess, lived in the southwest ever since, apart from a year spent in Greece. So I've moved rather away from my native land.
But I think it's almost inevitable when you're chasing opportunities when it comes down to work. And I think it's interesting that, you know, a few minutes ago you said, well, I haven't really got along that well with work. But if you look at the amount of work you do, it is astonishing. Like, you are a phenomenally busy person. You're whizzing all over the place, doing all sorts of things. So we can't say you don't work.
Oh, no.
Yeah, what you don't do is it's the 9 to 5, sit in an office and go tippity-tap on a keyboard, which, yeah, well done for escaping it. It's obviously the goal for many of us strange people to not do that anymore, or never do it at all if it can possibly be avoided. And in terms of your museum work, like, what are you working on at the moment, just to give people a sense of all the different things you're dashing between? What on the museum side is preoccupying you?
Well, these days I work in a museum in Swindon, which doesn't sound perhaps as glamorous as working in a museum in Cheltenham as I did before. Swindon has 3 museums, or it will do again very shortly. So I'm in the throes of helping my colleagues, the rest of the curatorial team, open the museum and art gallery in Swindon once more, which closed in 2020 and is just now reopening in a much better building than it was in previously. So that's really exciting. I worked there 15 years ago, so it's really great to come back to something which I had been working towards all those years ago. But even more excitingly, Swindon is part of the Wessex Museums Partnership, which is a national portfolio organisation funded by the Arts Council, which encompasses museums in Wiltshire, Salisbury and Devizes and Swindon, and in Dorset, which is Dorchester and Poole. And we're all working together on an exhibition about folk.
Excellent.
So folk culture.
Eleanor and I were at Dorchester Museum not long ago. Lovely museum. Brilliant, brilliant museum, I've got to say. But also museums across the course of my lifetime have undergone, it feels like, quite a philosophical change. The way that museums are presenting themselves and kind of almost the politics of museums has changed quite a lot. I mean, across the course of your career, how would you attempt, if you can, to characterise the kind of changes that have happened to museums across the last, you know, 30 years or so?
Well, ideologically, I suppose what's really happened is that although I would say that the public's perception of museum curators being stuck in an ivory tower doing research has not existed at any point in my career, and I've been working in museums since I was in my mid-20s and I'm now in my 50s, so that hasn't really existed. But we have come out more and more to realise that whilst we have a hoard of stuff and a hoard of information about that stuff, we are not the only ones who are able to speak about it. These are objects that belong to our communities, whatever those communities might be. It might be a national community or it might be a very local community. And what we now do is we go out to those communities and encourage them to work with us in interpreting, particularly if it's objects that pertain to a particular kind of community. And that's something we're definitely going to be doing within the folk exhibition. There are all sorts of different communities in Swindon alone, let alone the other museums, who all partake of folk culture in some way, and we want to bring all of that into the museum as well. So I'm going to be doing some contemporary collecting in the Swindon area around that to make sure that that is represented, not just objects but voices within the museum. And so now we want everyone's voice within a museum. It's not my voice is relevant, but it's not the only voice. Your voice, everybody's voice. We want to encourage people to feel like they're really part of their museums, that it is their community, their culture, and to help us shape how museums will go forward in the future.
How wonderful. It's absolutely brilliant. And I think, you know, anyone who's used to imagining museums as all being a bit like the Pitt Rivers, that's not the way the world is anymore. And I think you can still go to a museum that feels like that, But I think very few museums that we visit as we travel up and down the country are stuck with a static set of exhibits that have been occasionally dusted, but otherwise remain the same for some time. I think that sense in which so many museums are a bit like an iceberg, where what is on show at a given time is but the very, very tip of the collection. And that sense of responsibility around trying to get some of the stuff that's hidden and that's being researched on and that's in the archives out and into circulation and seen, while not hiding your star items in your exhibition. I mean, the politics of that must be very interesting and slightly difficult when you're engaging in museum curation, because there's always going to be those few things that each museum has that is very special. This is the only one of these that exists, and therefore we must put it front and center. And everywhere has pottery. Does that mean that we should not be showing so much pottery, not showing so many axe heads or spearheads or bits of flint? I mean, it's a really difficult business, I would have thought.
It is. The advantage, of course, that we have these days is that we have the ability to show those parts of the collection that aren't necessarily on display all the time digitally. So the resource is there for those who are after it. I mean, this is a really slow process. Museums have been chronically understaffed and underfunded for quite a few decades. I mean, certainly all my career. And it's not an improving picture at the moment. However, a lot of work has gone into trying to get collections recorded, documented fully. I mean, even the disaster at the British Museum, there was those items were accessioned. They had one number. But the idea is that we now know what every single item in our museum is, and it is fully documented, and that then is put out to the public. And that means the more research we do on things, the more that we can say, this is the object that we need. But I think for many local museums, it doesn't matter if there's a similar axe head in a museum down the road, because this is the axe head, this is the 1960s record player, this is the bust of a local mayor, whatever it might be, that is particular to your place and it has its own specific story to tell. And I think that makes a really good link to folklore as well, because that's extremely place specific usually. Even if you have a migratory legend, like, I mean, one that pops up all the time that I know is the fairy midwife or the fairy peel, in which the fairy midwife, you know, you have a midwife who is taken in the dead of night, possibly blindfolded, to a place that she doesn't know, and there helps a woman give birth in seemingly opulent circumstances. And the father gives her a pot of ointment and says, put this on the eyes of my child, and do not get any in your own eye. But of course she gets an itch in her eye. Of course she does, because you would, wouldn't you? And she rubs her eye, and then suddenly with that eye she sees that it is not an opulent place, but a poverty-filled one. And she doesn't say anything. She goes away, and then she sees the father stealing in the market, and she challenges him. And he says, what eye can you see me doing this? And she tells him, and he puts the eye out.
Yeah.
And that is known in most counties. In somewhere like Wiltshire, for example, that whole thing is expanded upon to be a really dark murder story that involves the death of a baby and a woman as well. But it's the same essential story. And yet the fairy midwife is also still there in Wiltshire. It's there in Suffolk. It's there in Gloucestershire. My friend David Phelps, who started the History Press series of books that I've written several of, he and I had a kind of running jest that we'd always, in our books, always have a black dog, for example. And there always was a black dog. There's got to be a black dog. I mean, Suffolk has the black dog, but I think possibly in Devon they might argue with that.
I know Mark Norman has written his book about how I think there are only perhaps two counties in all of Britain where there isn't a black dog legend. It's interesting when you're thinking about Suffolk, though. As somebody who grew up in Suffolk, what was it like? I mean, were there shucks down every lane and wild men in every watercourse and green children peeking out of every hedgerow? Was Suffolk a place full of folklore for you when you were little?
So I'm actually an incomer into Suffolk. We moved there when I was about three from London. My grandparents had a house there from the 1960s and my mum and I moved in with them. So I'm not Suffolk born and bred. So if you asked my very best friend at school, Angela, who was Suffolk born and bred and still lives there today and her children are grown up and I think starting to have children of their own, she told me when we were children that there was a black dog that lived at the bottom of my lane. So I lived in a little village called Lower Layham. Lower Layham has a macabre claim to fame through an association with a more famous village just up the road. And that was a story I definitely knew, but that's hardly a folktale because it really happened. Yeah. But there was definitely this black dog that lived. So I lived kind of up a farm track in what was two farm cottages in the middle of nowhere, opposite a hall. There was two farm cottages, three farm cottages and a modern house. That was it. Lower Layham is a very small village and we were outside it. And on the main road, so opposite where I lived and opposite the hall, a black dog walks. And it's a harbinger of death. But Angela's uncle has seen it and everybody was okay. So it kind of became, I think, for her family, kind of a friendly black dog. So she says that whenever she drives past there, she still lives very close to where I grew up, where she grew up. She waves at my house and where the black dog is, just in case she sees it, because you've got to keep it on side.
Yeah, of course you do.
I remember when I did Suffolk Folk Tales, my first of the two books about Suffolk that I did a straw poll amongst people coming to book signings. What have they heard of? Had they heard of XYZ? And nobody had heard of anything at all except black dogs. And wow. Everybody had heard of black dogs.
That's very interesting because, you know, for Eleanor and I, we love visiting Suffolk. Eleanor was born there, mm-hmm. But only lived there as an infant and then moved away. But for us, the landscape of Suffolk is riven. It's full, brimming over with stories over each hill in each town. But it's interesting that the black dog or black dogs are the ones that are kind of living in the mouths of people right now.
I mean, people certainly believed in ghosts. I mean, that's certainly the case. I mean, where my parents live now near the Suffolk coast, there are people who still believe in the ghost of Black Toby, a tragic tale from the 18th century and a ghost that's supposed to have haunted the area around Blythburgh ever since 1750 when he was put to death, not in Blythburgh, in Ipswich, but moving on. But he was then gibbeted.
Ghosts can move.
They can move. He was gibbeted there, so his body went and so his spirit went. And the woman that he's said to have murdered also still. And people really still believe that. And that's obviously quite a few years on from when I was a child. But for me, I think I had an advantage over some children because I grew up in the folk tradition. My parents, my mum and my stepfather, were folk musicians and still are folk musicians. And they went to the local folk clubs in Hadley and Ipswich and round and about. And so I was brought up listening to folk music. I didn't like it much at that time, but I was brought up listening to it and imbibing the stories. And my mum was also the props mistress for the Hadley Amateur Dramatic Society. And when I was about seven, they put on a play of The Green Children.
Wow.
So for me, black dogs are one thing, but The Green Children are it. But it's an entirely personal approach to it. I don't remember the play. I was too young to see it. My mum shared photographs with me since of the cast on the stage. And it was kind of a comic play. I've seen the script for it, which I don't really know how it can be because it's quite a tragic story, really. But she made a swan, a papier-mâché swan. And she made all the food for the feast. She made crowns and jewels and all sorts of things. And this was being made in her bedroom. And I was fascinated by this. And she told me the story of the Green Children. And I was fascinated by that. And it's one of the kind of first times that I really remember being particularly interested in a folktale, even though it'd be so strange. We moved away from Suffolk when I was about 10. We moved so far over the border into Norfolk.
Totally different.
Then we moved back to Suffolk again and then we moved to Norfolk again. But I spent my teenage years living in the Fens and I was much more interested there as a teenager, much more engaged in the local folklore of that area and also going to events. So I, as a small child, would go to the Morris dancing because my parents would follow and sometimes play for the East Suffolk Morris, which is still running to this day. And sometimes the Garland, I can't remember where they were based, but Garland dancers, I don't know whether you know that, they carry a semicircular garland and dance about with it. And I never wanted to do that, but that was all that was open to me in the 1980s as a girl.
So you did garland dance?
I did not garland dance because it didn't appeal to me as a young woman. No.
No, fair enough.
Hitting people with sticks, that would have appealed to me.
Yeah, some little bladder bops.
Yeah.
From Morrisman.
So it's really only as an adult that I've kind of come to the Suffolk folklore. And in some ways, it's actually through doing medieval studies that really tuned me into it and made me realise what was there. So when I was at university doing my medieval studies degree, I studied with Professor Martin Carver, who was one of the people who has, over the long time of Sutton Hoo being excavated, he was one of the main excavators from the 1970s to the 90s. And whilst we were there at York, we were taken down to the British Museum and I got to took the pin out of the shoulder clasp and put it back in again. That was possibly still one of the most exciting things that has ever happened in my whole life.
How amazing.
And I kind of realised, it's like, oh, Sutton Hoo, well, I've been there. It's just these mounds in a field, because that's all it was when I was growing up, the visitor centre, and none of that existed in those days. It was just some boring old mounds. And it kind of made me realise that actually the landscape was so much more interesting because, of course, we may know who the king possibly was, or certainly he would have been related to King Radwald. And Radwald is kind of tapped into the story of how Christianity came to Britain. So he's mentioned in Bede. He gets a proprium in Bede for having two altars, one to the pagan deities and one to Christ. He's one of the first people to have been baptised down in Kent by his overlord, rather by his bishop. And so he's nominally a Christian, but he's still, you know, he's hedging his bets. He doesn't quite understand what Christianity means. And Bede thinks he's a bit dilly because of this. But then he's part of the story of King Edwin. And Edwin comes down to East Anglia fleeing from King Athelthryth. And he hides there at Rendlesham. And of course, they've excavated Rendlesham now, which they hadn't when I was younger, but they knew that that's where Radwald had his palace, and so they found it. And it's, you know, to me, that's as exciting as finding Richard III, even though it's so much further ago.
Well, that almost makes it more exciting in my mind. And the fact that they're about to engage in a new set of excavations at Sutton Hoo and go back in and see what else they can find, I mean, it's absolutely thrilling.
It is thrilling, particularly in the light of not that much archaeology happening in except for developer archaeology these days.
Yeah, indeed. You know, it's a bit of a sad time when we are venturing about and researching all the counties and discovering about these amazing discoveries that were made about mass graves or about burial mounds or about, you know, particular, you know, lost places that people had a little poke around and a little look at between the 1850s and 1950s. And then nobody's looked at them since. And it's sort of mind-blowing to think there's so much under the ground up and down this nation, and yet there's no, it seems, appetite right now in government, sadly, to throw money at looking at this incredible heritage we have. It's very, very sad. As we said before, though, look at local archaeological societies and seeing what they're doing, because all hands on deck, everyone. There's still stuff to look for, and we need you on it.
And I have to disagree with you very slightly, because I think it can be, we can have a little bit of hubris about this in assuming that we're the ones who should be doing the digging up, and that perhaps if we leave it there, it might be safer in certain circumstances.
Certainly. So, I think there are lots of cases where things are sensibly reburied. To keep them safe and to stop them from being destroyed as well.
But yeah, although I'm totally with you on the other hand, because I just want to know. I want to know everything.
It's more the case of there are things that are mysterious that we know a little bit about, and we know that some Victorian gentleman who was a hobbyist had a bit of a fiddle about and went, well, this is quite interesting, isn't it? And then just left it. And now with all the things that we can apply, that we know, that we can do, and also with these museums, like the ones that you're working in, that would love to show some of this material to people and go, okay, look, this is the story of your people.
Yes.
I mean, personally, it doesn't get much more thrilling than that kind of thing.
No. Although I do have a lot of admiration for our Victorian fellows for what they did. I mean, I'm thinking of the Reverend Hollingsworth in Stowmarket.
Yes.
And literally, there's two pages at the back of his big book about his big bumper book of Stowmarket, which tells you all of the history of Stowmarket that you could possibly want to read. And I haven't read it, but I have read those two pages at the back where, for some reason, he is quite early at recording fairy lore. And so Stowmarket, you'd say, oh, well, Suffolk, there's not actually that many stories of fairies, but they're all in Stowmarket. So you've got the story of the man who hosts a fairy meeting in his house and they tidy up after him. You've got the quite spooky stories of the fairies that could be seen at certain areas in around where brick production was in Stowmarket. Most of these places completely gone. Stowmarket has had a lot of development. And then the most chilling one of all for me is the story of the woman who nearly loses her baby. She sees the child being taken and the steel pins, so not safety pins, but just pins that are pinning the baby's nappy on, being pulled out one by one by these little tiny sandy folk. So these are very diminutive fairies, the kind of size of fairies that we tend to imagine, as opposed to the more usual folkloric fairy, which is about the size of a 7 or 8 year old child, yeah. Or the great masterful fairies of the Celtic world, who are, if not as tall as us, if not they're bigger, grander, more beautiful, more everything. But these are little fairies and they're stealing babies away. And it turns out that this baby, who's nearly stolen but is grabbed back by her mother, is the one who's telling the story to Reverend Hollingsworth. She's the sister of the sexton, and she and the sexton, so this brother and sister, have all of these fairy stories. And they tell another story, I don't know, was from a different person, I think, and Reverend Hollingsworth, of a changeling, of a child. They're actually quite positive, these fairy stories. So you've got the guy who got money for letting the fairies have a party in his house, but you've also got the woman who looked after a fairy changeling when the changeling came to her, who grieved her own child, who was taken into the fairy world, but who nonetheless cared for and looked after the new baby and was paid a shilling by the fairies for her pain.
Very reasonable rate.
Very reasonable rate. It certainly would have been, because most of these stories are not from the 1850s. These are probably stories from the late 18th century, because they're remembered from the childhoods of the older people who are in their 70s, maybe 80s. Certainly the sister of the sexton is about 80. That's recorded in those two pages of lore. And it's so tantalising to have that. And what I think is really interesting as well with the story of the fairy changeling is that that takes place at a place called Langham, which could be the Lanaham, might not be, in one of Ralph of Cogshall's stories about a fairy changeling, or what seems to be about something that seems very like a fairy changeling. So Dr. Francis Young would have my head for saying categorically that it was.
But tantalising. We can connect these things together.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When we're talking about this shift that happens in the late 18th century, running through the 19th century, where we get hobbyists, because there's no other terminology and there's no real sense of how to engage in, you know, what we today would call like a scientific study. You know, these are, people are innovating and inventing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think also the notion of even writing down stories and trying to make sense out of them as an art form. I mean, I'm a romantics guy, so I'm very interested in romanticism and how that kind of grew out of the Gothic and Orientalism into this supernatural, natural discussion. And I know that one of your areas of sort of passion and expertise is the arts and crafts movement. And, you know, obviously you've got lots of strands to your career, but when we think about, when we think about that 19th century development, I mean, we might, on the podcast, we tend to refer to it as the folk revival. This idea that people were then looking back, particularly in the late 19th century, to try and find traditions and to bring them back in the kind of wake of industrialization, really. And there's almost a response there. And the arts and crafts movement, in my mind, fits very squarely into that. But for someone who doesn't really know who the arts and crafts main players were or what the arts and crafts movement was, how would you try and summarize what was going on in the arts and crafts movement? And what part do you think that had to play in, I guess, the folk boom that we can recognize happening in the late 19th century or mid to late 19th century?
I mean, you're absolutely right to say that this is something that has come out of Romanticism in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And in Britain, everything comes to a head around a group of young men and women in the 1850s and 60s, who will go on to be the fathers and mothers of the arts and crafts movement, essentially. So when William Morris, who is a figure that I imagine most people will have heard of, we know him as a wallpaper designer. That's not what he was known as in the Victorian period. He was most famous for being a poet. And he and his friend Edward Burne Jones, as we know him now, were at Oxford together. So these were two different ends of the middle classes. Ned Jones was a picture framer's child, William Morris an industrialist's child, and they both came to the same college, shared the same passions. They wanted to go into the church, but they were absolutely in love with books like Sidonia the Sorceress. They discovered Malory's Morte d'Arthur. They discovered Chaucer. And what they were discovering there, of course, when they were finding out about King Arthur and the stories that Chaucer records, was a long history of being interested in the folklore of our island. I mean, obviously, the matter of Britain was incredibly important to the 19th century. And Victorian Britain embraced the idea of King Arthur alongside the real medieval kings as the model of chivalry in an age that believed itself to be chivalrous whilst it was still thoroughly exploiting its working classes and women and people overseas quite a lot too. But anyway, William Morris, his money came from not particularly good industrial practices. So that's tricky. But he and Burne Jones, they met up with the Pre-Raphaelites, Dante Gabriel Rossetti in particular. They became friends and together they shared this love, this passion for these romantic stories, and they began to paint them, to draw them, to write about them. And all really part of the same thing is whilst decorating your home, so Red House in Bexley Heath, William Morris and his friends decorated it together, men and women working together to decorate with embroidery and painting and everything that you could imagine, their house with stories. And what an inspiration this was to the next generation to not only tell stories, but also make things in a way that was recognisable to the people of the past. So rather than embracing the industrial future, which we've ended up with, they wanted to go back to what was before, in a way. So there was the Gothic revival throughout the 19th century, where the idea was that the Middle Ages kind of had it right. I mean, there was a Catholic revival at this time as well, which was part of that. And the belief that it was a kinder place in the Middle Ages where you were looked after by guilds and so on. This is obviously complete rubbish. there was a recognition that whilst we think about folk traditions dying out, that all traditions were dying out, that people didn't know how to make all sorts of different crafts, particularly associated with building. Most of the designers of the arts and crafts movement were architects. And they came out of that Gothic revival tradition being taught by their mentors to learn how to do everything. So to visit all sorts of old places, churches, manor houses, and they were middle class young men, so they could do that. And to steep themselves in the vernacular traditions of the country, of building, of all crafts, gardens, and of stories. So these things all kind of went forward together. And so they formed societies and they started to create buildings and fill them with everything that we would require in our lives, from settees to tables, to light fittings, to the clothes that we wear, the jewellery that we might wear, to beautiful books that you would store in your houses. All of these things. Well, the ideal was to make things by hand. Of course, some people did use some kind of machinery. To use your head, your heart and your hands to make work that would feed the soul. And it was felt that the life of the countryside rather than the city was a better way of living. So when C.R. Ashby moved to the Cotswolds, he wanted to take his workmen for the Guild of Handicraft that had been in the East End of London from the city, which he said made his workers callous and thriftless. So they were not really that caring and they didn't know how to manage their money, to his City of the Sun, Chipping Campden, which is a small town in North Gloucestershire. And there you would find a paradise, essentially. A City of the Sun is from a utopian book in the 16th century. Of course, it wasn't a utopia, but many people went back to the land to live the simple life. These are phrases, back to the land and the simple life, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And it was many of these people who were the ones who were most engaged in working. It was almost like the kind of community curation that I was talking about, but in a rather more patronising way of ensuring that what they saw at a period that from the First World War on was particularly was accelerated was the depopulation of the countryside, industrialization of the countryside. Obviously, there'd always been industry there, and a completely different way of life coming in from the towns that was desired by the people who lived in the country, who wanted to have the amenities that people were starting to get in the towns. And so they were desperately trying to capture all of that and to kind of turn the clock back whilst at the same time creating objects that were completely modern.
And kind of to a certain degree being very clever. I mean, when you think about Wedgwood as an example, you know, a utopian project to a certain degree, very clever in the way that he managed his business, came out of, again, an intellectual middle-class background, well, a combination of powerful families. Very interesting, this kind of melting pot in the 19th century as it more or less, and as you said, you know, utopian ideas aren't new. They had existed beforehand. But as we proceed from the arts and crafts movement, I would argue, we then get a new kind of folk movement or a set of folk movements and a new set of rules and ideas that inform a lot of craft practice.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the kind of studio makers who work today, a lot of their thinking, and I've met in my long years working with arts and crafts in Cheltenham, many, many craft practitioners would say that they were still inspired by the work of the arts and crafts movement. Not maybe so much by William Morris, maybe what he wrote, perhaps not his works, but by the integrity of the craftsmanship and the use of materials by the arts and crafts makers and that engagement, but transformation of the past.
Fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because so the composer Ralph Vaughan Williams, who is one of these people who's very interested to creating contemporary music for his time. I mean, it's not pop music, but it is contemporary music of the time that he lived. He was very interested in folk songs, as was Gustav Holst. And Vaughan Williams actually came to Suffolk to do some collecting. There's a little book that I found, and I haven't found the stories anywhere else. It was published in the 1980s, that had a series of fascinating ghost and other stories about Southwold that were collected at that time. And there's one of them about this master mariner called William Hur. And these are ordinary stories that are being collected from ordinary people, fisher folk and others in Southwold. But it's being collected by our middle class friends. This wasn't always the case. In Swindon, where I work now, just to veer into Wiltshire again for a moment, there is a collector called Alfred Williams who was collecting at the same time in the early 20th century. And he'd started out in his early teens as a farm labourer, and then he worked at the railway works in Swindon for the Great Western Railway. He taught himself 8 languages, including Sanskrit. So he is a kind of example of those men, particularly, but women as well, of the early 20th century, who were very set on improving themselves to be like the middle classes, which is perhaps not how we approach things now. But for him, it was absolutely key that he went out
liberal
to record himself as a man who knew these people, who'd known those stories since he was a child and the songs that people sang in the pubs and in people's houses. And he recorded 800 folk songs in the Thames Valley area, which is amazing. That's and he worked a full-time job at the railway works and cycled to and from it 4 miles each way and did all of this research and wrote poetry.
Sensational.
So those people are always everywhere as well. So it's maybe not quite as much of a middle-class thing. It captured the whole imagination of people at that time, and we have a lot to be grateful for. I mean, the two books that I've done, a lot of the work had already been done. I'm a storyteller, not a folklorist. So for me, it's a question of retelling the stories to create an adapted story that is engaging to read, that tells the story for our time in my way. As a writer, I can do that. As a storyteller, you know, a little bit more to and fro because the audience is also involved. And so I wasn't necessarily doing collecting myself, although we did do a little bit, myself and my mum, of collecting from people. Most of the information came from books, and most of that was collected in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness. Absolutely. And so you are a highly acclaimed storyteller. You know, you it's one of the many things that you're zipping about the country doing all the time. But when you think back to growing up in the folk tradition, as you described with your mum and dad being folk musicians and so on, were you encountering what we think of today as storytellers?
Nope, not at all. No. No. Well, there were some people who were telling stories a bit in the 1970s and 80s in festivals. The storytelling revival kind of lagged behind the folk song revival by a few decades, and it is a revival of the 80s and even into the 90s. I guess the first kind of proper storytelling revival thing that I went to was when I was an undergraduate. It was in the Crick Crack Cup in Norwich by Ben Haggerty. So I think he was doing Madeira and Adoin, if I recall. I don't quite know how I remember that all these years on, but anyway.
It made an impression.
Made an impression on me, but it was not something that I thought that one could do. I think that even today, there is still a division, and as someone who's very into the arts and crafts movement, I don't approve of this, because for them, everything was about unity of art. And so all the arts were equal with each other, and you could be engaged with all of them. And as someone who does lots of things all the time, I completely approve of that.
Yes,
there's still people who are interested in folk music might not be so interested in stories, and vice versa, because the musicianship that goes into folk music is so key. And obviously that's not part of storytelling at all. It's a different set of skills. And so you still don't hear that much storytelling within the folk music world. Storytelling sits outside it, and there is still a perception that it is just for children. Just a constant fight to help people realise that we are telling stories all the time, that we're listening to stories all the time, that storytelling is kind of what we are.
I mean, I think the simplest way of communicating this idea is that we only understand things through stories.
Certainly.
Even the most hard-nosed mathematician at a certain point has to recognise that the numbers that they're using are all metaphors for something else. They have to. They're all symbols that they've ascribed meaning to, and you're telling me a story through an equation. That's absolutely fine, but that's how human beings function. So let's not muck about and pretend it's anything but.
No, indeed.
You mentioned Norwich before, and having grown up both in Suffolk and Norfolk and hopping about between those two East Anglian counties. Now, we don't want to start a war here, Kirsty.
No.
I'm going to throw a cat amongst the pigeons.
Uh-huh.
When we think about Suffolk and Norfolk, are we talking about two very distinct cultures across those different county lines? Or are we talking about one kind of contiguous culture, one contiguous set of communities? Is East Anglia all just one, or does Suffolk stand alone? Is it special in some ways?
Well, it's probably a mix, to be diplomatic. As I say, I lived in Suffolk and then Norfolk and then in the Fens. And the Fens felt different. It is a very different kind of landscape to any of the landscapes that you get in Norfolk and Suffolk. There is always this joke that there's like a massive enmity between Norfolk and Suffolk.
Yeah.
But if we reach back not too many decades, then you've got two Suffolks which are completely different from each other. And that if you're from East Suffolk, you're very different from somebody from West Suffolk. And when I was growing up in the Fens, my best friend's mum was from Wisbeach and we lived in Upwell. They were 8 miles away from each other. And she was considered to be a foreigner in the village. So wherever you have these communities, there's obviously going to be people are looking for differences. To me, as an early medievalist, and I think this is where we're going to get the most diplomatic, to me as an early medievalist,
yeah.
Norfolk and Suffolk are the same. They are both part of the Kingdom of East Anglia. So I see relationship across the border that a river can't obliterate. The Waveney is obviously important and there are differences, but you have two sets of farming communities, two sets of fishing communities, and two sets of towns. You have the city, which Suffolk doesn't have.
Yep.
But you had the massively important monastery in Bury St Edmunds during the Middle Ages that meant that Suffolk, well, West Suffolk specifically, was very important. But you had Ipswich down in East Suffolk that was an important trading port. And so each place had its own particularities. And Suffolk was perhaps richer than Norfolk with the wool trade. But I think from the perspective now of living in Gloucestershire, to me, they seem much more similar. I mean, certainly if you look at those Black Dog stories again, they are very similar across the two counties.
Even Shuck himself.
The Shuck himself.
Stay in just.
Well, Shuck himself is actually from Suffolk, of course. I mean, he is the Earl of Suffolk. He is Hugh Bigod. So I think we definitely have to claim the Shuck himself for Suffolk. I'm sorry. But the Black Dogs generally, yes, they can be for the both. But Black Shuck is, no, he's not.
Shots fired.
There's a story that Hugh Bigod, a 12th century ambitious person, did sell his soul to the devil and thus became the Shuck. And the Shuck first manifests in a story in the Middle Ages, which intrigued me, as scaring a boy to death in Bungay Castle, which is excellent. Well, it's not excellent, it's awful.
It's a great story. Yeah, there we go.
Oh dear. That's me revealed, isn't it? But I do think that it's all much. I mean, the Fens, I think, is quite different. So you've got Norfolk Fens, Cambridgeshire Fens, Lincolnshire Fens. And so that the landscape there informs the stories that you find in those places that have a very different and much shorter history. But of course, you still have Etheldreda, Aethelthryth in Ely, who is part of the East Anglian royal family. So there's always connectivity. It's all very different from Essex, though.
Yes, very different from Essex. In terms of another place in Suffolk, of course, that wasn't on your list because we no longer have it, Dunwich.
Dunwich.
Very, very important place in its time.
I've always wanted to hear the bells ringing. My parents live very close to what remains of Dunwich, and I often go out to walk, particularly in snowdrop time, because there's a lovely snowdrop wood in Greyfriars Wood. It's like a 10-minute walk along the cliff top. And there's still one gravestone from the last church of Dunwich. And it's right on the edge. And I kind of think to myself as I go along, well, I'm in my 50s now and it's been in the same place. But now we're getting more storms, perhaps. will I see it go down in my lifetime?
Hey, well.
I mean, there's not actually that much in the way of stories there. I mean, compared to, for example, the Orford Merman, what we really have is the bells ringing underneath the sea. And of course, we know the bells won't be ringing underneath the sea because the town was obliterated over successive storm surges that took it away over an enormously long period of time, but not all in one go. And of course, it was all minced up. But I still kind of have it imagining in my mind a pristine little city underneath the sea.
You know, early on in our conversation, you were talking about sometimes it's known as the fairy spit, but the person who sees the fairy world in one eye and how that alters their life and often has a tragic outcome. The number of English counties where there are some bells from a church that ring underwater, I mean, I think almost everyone has one of those as well.
Yep, and Welsh.
Yeah,
as well.
Definitely. Okay, so for listeners who don't know Suffolk, we've been talking about it, you know, in general terms, but if you were to be the ambassador to describe what Suffolk is like, I mean, how would you describe the county to somebody who's never been?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I mean, it's kind of in my blood. For me, I'm always drawn to the sea. So let's whip straight across Suffolk, first of all, to start from the coast. It has, of course, got its beautiful Sheshe beaches at Southwold and Warberswick. But if you start at the top from Cove Hythe, and I don't think you're even allowed to walk there at the moment because the cliff is collapsing, you have that sense of precariousness of the landscape, of sand dunes and marshes running along the coast that gives you an idea of non-permanence, because as you say, Dunwich was washed away, and seemingly even today bits of Suffolk are being drifted down to Essex is most unfair. But then in the heart of the county you have this fantastic land that is good for farming, and you have a great agrarian community, but it also used to be a place with a lot of cattle farming. Did you know that? I didn't know that. And it this quite well off county with its wonderful wool churches that speaks of a place that was rich during the Middle Ages, that gives us fantastic buildings to look at, but then became poorer. Now, Suffolk and Norfolk as well have always been at the forefront of agricultural reform. So now you have these massive fields that are very different from the hedgerow fields of my childhood. But these are little places where stories easily grow up amongst the half-timbered, pink-painted architecture and these very rich churches in the heart of their communities, and pubs, many, many pubs, many, many pubs. Many of the folk tales talk about pubs and how you can hear stories in pubs that you probably shouldn't believe. And there's, when you think of that kind of cosy chocolate box, Constable country, Suffolk, I always counter that in my mind with the word mardle, thinking about the kind of pragmatism and wit of the ordinary Suffolk people who would roll their eyes at any of these silly stories that we might be telling, whether they be silly to be holy stories or whether they be silly stories that are actually a bit daft. And also would be very happy to trick an incomer. But that doesn't mean to say that it's not a place that looks outward as well, with the trading port particularly of Ipswich and obviously of Felixstowe too, connecting us to the outside world. And, you know, this is the county that gave us one of our patron saints. St. Edmund was martyred somewhere in Suffolk.
Somewhere.
We don't necessarily know where. Hoxton was claimed. His body was certainly taken to Bury St. Edmunds. It became one of the biggest shrines in the country during the Middle Ages. And St. Edmund was the patron saint of England for a while, at least. And so, you know, those stories are really important.
It's also something that I don't think people often talk about, an incredibly flat county.
It's not flat.
Well, it's not wholly flat.
It's not flat.
It's big sky country. When you're driving to Suffolk.
My mother always says, Suffolk is not flat. that you've got to get the flat idea of Suffolk out of your mind. Remember, we've lived in Norfolk and the Fens.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Norfolk and particularly the Fens is obviously reclaimed land. That is flat. Suffolk is in the main a very gently rolling county. Okay. Admittedly, Simon Knott has just put up on Twitter that Norfolk has the lowest high point in Britain and Suffolk has the second lowest high point.
Okay, so you've mentioned loads and loads of interesting bits of folklore as we've been having this conversation. Do you have, and I know this is an almost impossible question to ask someone, but do you have a favourite bit of folklore from Suffolk and why?
Well, in theory, it's the Green Children, but we've already talked about that. So I'll tell you a more, one that makes me laugh because I don't know quite what it tells us, but it tells us something. Now, there are at least three Cloptons in Suffolk. There's one right on the western edge of the county, and there's one in the middle, and there's one towards the east of the county. And in two of those places, the saint who brought Christianity to Britain left some treasure. So this is St. Felix, and he left some treasure there. Of course, this is what saints do. But he didn't just leave it there, just randomly leave it there. He left it with a monk and a dog in each case. So what do we have? In Clopton, I'm going to get this right way around. In Clopton, in the east, we have a monk-headed dog.
Oh, wow.
And in Clopton, in the middle of the county, never mind the one in the west, in the Clopton in the middle of the county, you've got a dog-headed monk.
Wow.
It's obviously the same story. I don't know to which Clopton it originally pertained, but I just love the fact that you have these two separate traditions, but they went different ways. And now one is haunted by a dog-headed monk and the one is haunted by a monk-headed dog.
That's so interesting. And you wonder if the two could ever meet and just make the swap, whether they no longer be haunted at all, because they would have returned the right body parts to the right creatures.
Well, I think that's only possible if someone manages to actually take the treasure.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's tricky, isn't it? Because it's very difficult to take ghost treasure.
Oh, notoriously so. I don't know if you've ever tried it, but it's a tricky business.
I'm a storyteller. I've heard the stories I wouldn't try.
Yeah, very wise. Very wise. Okay, in which case, I have three final questions, Kirsty, because I feel like we could talk all night long and it would be amazing the whole time, but you've got museums to curate and talks to give and stories to tell and about 1,000 other things to do. So my first question is, if someone was planning a visit to Suffolk, which place or places would you say they absolutely must visit and why?
I think it would be really good to visit Bungay and Blythburgh, particularly Blythburgh, because on the north door at Blythburgh, you can see the scratch marks left by the black dog that visited on the 4th of August 1577 in the midst of a storm. I think that you should visit Woolpit for the Green Children and imagine how it must have been when two poachers found two children with bright green skins in the ground and how it felt for those children to be found there in this strange bright world. I think you should visit Orford and go to the castle there, down to the dungeon, and there see what it was like for the wild man taken from the sea who was imprisoned there. Actually, I think it's very sad. I think you should go everywhere, frankly. And you probably should go to Bury St Edmunds, which has an awful lot of stories, but try not to go into the tunnel under the Angel because you will not come out.
Ooh, well, that's tantalising.
Well, I mean, if you're a dog, you might come out, but if you are a person, you probably won't. And go to Sutton Hoo and see if you can see Radwald standing on his mound. Go to Rendlesham and see if you see aliens.
Yeah. And this is the thing about Suffolk. Like some counties, there are a few places to visit, you know, a handful. But it feels like I said earlier, everywhere. There is something to see everywhere, a story everywhere. It's an incredible landscape, rich with tales. I think you'd really struggle to just go there and see a couple of things. I think you need to spend a chunk of time, don't you, really, having a wander.
I think you definitely do. But what was interesting when I first started my Suffolk Folk Tales book is that the general idea was amongst people who were talking very generally about stories, is there's not many stories in Suffolk, you know.
Yeah.
You could do another book.
Oh, you could definitely, and should do another one. I think that there's a lot of people who own the first who would really love to, and your ghost stories book, who would also like another. Okay, second question. What piece of Suffolk lore or an aspect of Suffolk's history and culture do you wish people knew? Because, you know, people have misconceptions about all different counties in this country, but is there one particular Suffolk nugget that you think, I wish everybody just knew this about Suffolk?
Do you know, we've spent quite a lot of time in the Middle Ages, haven't we?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think maybe we should move forward and remember that there are ghosts still being formed during the 20th century and no doubt still today. And what I find interesting is that folklore never stands still. So obviously we have the Rendlesham aliens. Well, that's one thing, and that's not what I would want to talk about. But well, I found it really interesting that there were quite a lot of ghosts that haunted the airfields. So either the American bases or those airfields that were, because Suffolk is quite flat, relatively flat, and also very close to the coast and within easy range of the limited amount of fuel that a plane during the Second World War would have to go into the continent, and how there are ghosts of airmen, particularly in the Bracklands, who during the war helped to foil Germans coming in and dropping their bombs. And this was believed in the airfields at the time, and there's still ghosts haunting them in those airfields, some of which are still either airfields or look like an airfield. There's not much been built on them. And I think that's really interesting because it tells us that whilst we tend to think of folklore as something of the past, something to be collected from local people, that in these times of extremists during the Second World War, people needed to have stories to help them deal with strange things that were happening and to give them a bit of hope.
Yeah, that makes an awful lot of sense. And I always think it's interesting the way that tragic events in so many towns and so many cities and often in villages too are reframed through a folkloric lens, which
Absolutely.
Helps us to understand and consolidate the pain yeah. of something that's happened. Yeah, a very beautiful example, Kirsty. Thank you. Last question then.
Right.
People want to learn more about Suffolk's history and folklore. Where would you recommend they look?
Well, I might want to recommend my own books, of course. Yeah. So those are Suffolk Folk Tales and Suffolk Ghost Tales, published by the History Press. The Ghost Tales one written in conjunction with my mother, Cherry Wilkinson. But I would say that if you want to dig a bit deeper than that, then you need to look at the work of Dr. Francis Young, who particularly has written about St. Edmund, who is such an important figure in Suffolk that it would be difficult not to look at it. And another book is Suffolk Landscape, which gives us the kind of bedrock is the wrong word in Suffolk, but gives us the bedrock of where a lot of these stories are actually coming from, because it tells the history of the land of the place itself, which I think is interesting. So do check out. I mean, unfortunately, Francis's book, Suffolk Fairy Lore, is currently out of print. But if you can track down a copy of that, he really goes into depth. But he's going to be writing more about fairies and has written about fairies in the Middle Ages as well. So that would be a fantastic place to start. And he has so many different books about Suffolk and a little bit of Cambridgeshire lore as well, that I would start with him. Well, after you've read my books.
Yeah, of course. After you've read, check them out first. Well, Kirsty, thank you so much for speaking to me today. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, it's been really good. Thank you so much for inviting me on. It's been such a pleasure to talk about so many diverse things, not surprisingly.
Man, man.
How about that then? Kirsty Hartsey Otis. What a lovely person and a font of knowledge. In case you were wondering, at the end there, the book Kirsty was referring to, Suffolk Landscape, is by Norman Scarfe. That's S-C-A-R-F-E, and it's very good. Highly recommend it. We will be back on Monday with an all-new episode. This time, Eleanor's taking us to Somerset, the county of my birth, with an all-new story, of course. And next Thursday, we'll have a bonus Three Ravens Bestiary episode all about dragons. So that's going to be epic. Plus, next Saturday's episode of Local Legends will be an interview with folklore podcaster, Instagrammer and YouTuber Fairy Folk. If you don't know her, she's a very mysterious character. Nobody knows who she is. She never shows her face. Theories go, she might not even have one. But one big secret that I can reveal right now is that she's from Somerset. So she'll be sharing insights with me about the county and her work from a different perspective, that of our youngest local legend for this series. As always, if you have 5 minutes, please do review Three Ravens wherever you get your podcasts. Check the website for merchandise and expanded information about our episodes at threeravenspodcast.com. Email us your local folklore or entries to our Three Ravens ghost story competition at threeravenspodcast@gmail.com. 3,000 words maximum, please, and make them good and scary. And do join us in all the usual places on social media. facebook.com/threeravenspodcast, Instagram at threeravenspodcast, and on Twitter at threeravenspod. And to chat with other lovely Three Ravens listeners, do join the Three Ravens podcast group on Facebook. Of course, to support the podcast and unlock a ton of exclusive content, as well as ad-free listening, please sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/threeravenspodcast. And don't forget that you can learn more about Kirsty, her work, and her books on her website at kirstyhartseyotis.com. In the meantime, though, while our local legend has gone that way, we'll go this way. And remember, don't whistle until you're out of the woods. Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour, and our logo is by Ollie James Dare. The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, written and produced by me, Martin Vaux. Thanks for listening.
God send every such hounds, such hawks, such leemen, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Tsinis.
Kayla Tsinis. I'm Kayla Tsinis, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.